fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
A wonderful Wednesday to you, and what a Wednesday it is. It is a Class A feast day, so happy feast day to all of you. It's the solemnity of the Immaculate Conception. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 1-888-914-9149. Got a good show brewing for you today. Got a really good one percolating. Once again, that number to call, 888-914-9149. You can also follow me on Twitter, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. Show account is at Cale Clark Show. And you can email the program, show ideas, Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. Any questions that you have, we can try to answer them on the show. All right, so once again, today is really just a great feast day. It is one of the four Marian dogmas of the church. These are doctrines that you have to believe to be Catholic. It is the Immaculate Conception. And by the way, if you can even explain this to somebody else rightly, you've done them a great service, because so many people, even Catholics, are confused about what the Immaculate Conception is. And that includes even some very famous names, some very smart people, people like Ben Stein. Remember Ben Stein? He, of course, appeared in one of my favorite movies of all time, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. He was the teacher. Remember, he's doing the roll call, looking for Ferris Bueller, looking for Cameron Frye. You know, Bueller, Bueller, Frye. Anyone, remember that guy? Well, of course, he had that show, Win Ben Stein's Money, and he was actually asked this question. And the host at that time was a very young Jimmy Kimmel. Check this out.
The Immaculate Conception defines what biblical figure's birth?
Christ.
No. Ben Stein, how does it feel to lose $5,000 of your hard-earned money? Ben, with four.
Congratulations, although I have to say I'm going to protest this one. It's the only time I've ever said it, but the Immaculate Conception has to relate to the birth of Christ. What else can it be about?
No, it's the Virgin Mary.
You too. Come on, let's go.
All right, well, congratulations anyway, even though you cheated. You just won all this money, and I am unhappy about it. I'm impressed. I'm humbled. Get out of here. I hate you. I can't believe that. That has to be wrong. It has to be. Let's see the question.
We'll look at it later.
No, that has to be wrong. I'm not going to part with the money this easily.
All right. So I challenge all of you out there to write, call, or email.
It is totally about, it says about his birth, not about the conception.
We're going to have to stuff it in.
I got to jump in here. So Ben Stein was beside himself in that episode. He was only half joking. He really was livid, because he thought there's no way that can be right. And so many people think this. Even somebody as smart as Ben Stein think that the Immaculate Conception is about the virginal conception of Jesus in the womb of Mary. That is a totally different feast. That's the Annunciation. That's the one that we celebrate on March the 25th, 9 months before Christmas. That is not the Immaculate Conception. So Ben Stein, smart as he is, he got it wrong. So don't feel bad. If you ever have had trouble explaining this, if you've ever fallen into that trap, don't feel bad. It's also not this, sports fans.
Last chance for the Steelers. Bradshaw trying to get away. And his pass is broken up by Tatum. Tipped off. Rachel Harris has it. And he's when you talk about Christmas miracles, here's the miracle of all miracles.
Okay, so the Immaculate Reception by Steelers legend Franco Harris in the 1970s, part of the Steel Curtain Dynasty. I know Patrick Alog is really upset about that as a Raider fan. That was another bad luck play for the Raiders. Big deflection play. One of the most famous plays, if not maybe the most famous play in football history. And if you've ever been to the Pittsburgh airport, there is a statue of Franco Harris commemorating this. It's the Immaculate Reception, but that is not, folks, the Immaculate Conception. So what on earth is the Immaculate Conception? Well, let me give you the actual definition of this, and we'll give you a way to explain this. And by the way, in just a few minutes, I'm going to share with you, obviously, the Marian teachings of the church are difficult for non-Catholics to believe. And with my friends who are Protestants, again, even if they're really smart, really biblically minded, they really have a tough time with especially this doctrine. And there's a great article that came out today. I thought it was so interesting, by a former evangelical. He was one of the leading evangelical Christians really in the world, who converted to Catholicism recently. He's got a book coming out in a few months about this, about his conversion story. He came out with a piece today, and I'll share this with you later, about some of the things that always bugged him when he was a non-Catholic about the Immaculate Conception from a psychological point of view. And I think it's really fascinating because I think this, I'll just kind of spill the beans right now on one of the items, because I think it affects people today big time in the Catholic Church. Even my wife talks about this. So some people say, I find it hard to relate to the concept of Mary being without sin. She's so perfect. I just feel like I can't relate to her at times. So ladies, do you ever feel like that? You know, as a wife, as a mom, do you ever feel, if you are a wife or a mother, if you're not, do you ever feel like it's hard to relate to Mary because of her sinlessness? What do you think about that? I want to hear about that. And not just the ladies, anybody. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. 888-914-9149. Toll free to talk to me on the Cale Clark Show. I want to get your take on that. Do you find it hard to relate to Mary because of this, or is it not a problem? So let me give you the actual definition of the Immaculate Conception. And this was promulgated on December the 8th, 1854, by Pope Pius IX. And here's how he officially defined the dogma of the Immaculate Conception. And these doctrinal definitions are always so tight. They're always so, like, theologically precise. So here are the words. And this is from a papal bull. And there's no bull here. This is totally true. If the church defines it, you know it's true. Here's what he said. The Most Holy Virgin Mary was, in the first moment of her conception, by a unique gift of grace and privilege of Almighty God, and in view of the merits of Jesus Christ, the Redeemer of mankind, preserved free from all stain of original sin. So there's basically three things he said there, Pope Pius IX. He said, number one, Mary was absolutely preserved from original sin from the very first moment of her existence. Okay, it's not that way with us, but with Mary, it was the case. So never for even a nanosecond was she ever stained by original sin. The second thing that the Pope said is that the church, this technically doesn't deal with the question of did Mary commit any actual sins in her life. But the church has always taught that Mary never committed any personal sins either. So we'll talk about that later. We'll talk about how that came to be, that realization came to be. The third thing what the Pope mentioned when he officially defined this dogma, this teaching of the faith, you got to believe to be Catholic, is that it's a gift that was given to Mary because of the merits of her son, Jesus Christ, the Redeemer of mankind. So one of the things that we'll talk about later on is this great theologian of the church, John Duns Scotus. And even though his name was John Duns Scotus, he was no theological dunce. He was a dunce, not a dunce. And he was a really smart guy. And one of the things that he realized was that, hey, Mary does need a savior. A lot of non-Catholics want to say, well, does this mean that Mary doesn't need a savior? She doesn't need to be redeemed. She even says in the Magnificat, that famous hymn that she says in Luke's gospel, my spirit rejoices in God, my savior. So yes, God is her savior as well. But the way that God saved her was different than the way God saves us. It was a proactive salvation. And here's the example that John Duns Scotus said. basically, when we sin, it's like falling into a muddy pit. And there's a couple different ways you can save somebody from a muddy pit, you know, in real life. You can either prevent them from falling into a muddy pit in the first place. Hey, don't go there. Don't walk down that path. You're going to fall into the mud. Or you can, you know, after they've fallen into the mud, you can pull them up and hose them off. That takes a lot more work. It's a lot more messy. That's basically what happens with the rest of us, in that we, the merits of Christ's redeeming work are applied to us after the fact, after we have sinned. But in Mary's case, she never fell into sin in the first place. She was prevented from ever being stained with original sin. So it's a proactive redemption. And that's a really good insight from the 13th century theologian John Duns Scotus. All right, so that's what the teaching actually is. That's what the teaching actually is. So we're going to get into what the early fathers taught about, the fathers of the church taught about the Immaculate Conception, because this is one of the big Protestant objections to it, that the fathers didn't teach it, but they actually did. We're going to get into that later on. But let's look at the Bible. What does the Bible have to say about this? Well, there's something in the book of Genesis that's called the first gospel. In Genesis chapter 3, when Adam and Eve fall into sin, they take the bait, take the fruit, they're tricked, they give into it, Original sin is now in the world. And then in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, this is known as the proto-evangelium, or first gospel. Here's what God says: I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and hers. He will strike at your head while you strike at his heel. Now, this word enmity means total opposition, total opposition. Now, God is obviously not, he's talking to the serpent, by the way, who's the Satan. I will put enmity between you and the woman. Well, he can't be talking about Eve. Eve can't be the woman, because they're already kind of in league. Anybody who's committed a sin is in some way in league with the enemy. But this can't be the first Eve. He's got to be talking about another woman. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and hers. He will strike at your head while you strike at his heel. So this total enmity must be referring to another woman, and that is the second Eve, Mary. That's why in John's gospel, Jesus calls her woman. He's not being rude to his mom at the wedding feast of Cana in Galilee. They've run out of wine. Woman, what does this have to do with me? He's not being rude. He's calling her woman because she is that woman prophesied in the very first book of the Bible. So total enmity. And that has to mean that there is no any modicum of cooperation between Mary and the devil. No sin, no original sin, no personal sin. The Passion of the Christ movie by Mel Gibson really did a good job of kind of showing this in a visual way. There's a scene in which Mary is following her son along the way of the cross, and she kind of looks across the street and she sees the devil, and he's going in the other direction. He's not following Christ, obviously. He's walking in the complete opposite direction, and he's kind of trying to like intimidate Mary, staring her down from across the street. And to me, that was a sign of the total enmity between Mary and the enemy. So I love that scene. I thought that was really, really good. And also in the Passion of the Christ, speaking of this proto-evangelium in Genesis, when God says the offspring of the woman will crush the head of the serpent. He will strike your head, you will strike at his heel. There's a scene in the agony in the garden in that movie where Satan is trying to kind of say, you know, your father doesn't love you, God's not, you know, God doesn't care about you. And Jesus is praying in the garden, and there's this little snake. Remember this? If you've seen the movie, there's a sort of garden snake that kind of slithers out from Satan's robe, and then Jesus stands up and bam, he like smashes the head of the snake with his heel. I thought, oh, that's awesome. That's Genesis 3:15 right there, the proto-evangelium on film. So that's one place where you can find some scriptural evidence for this. Another very famous verse is in Luke chapter 1, verse 28. And this is the gospel of the day. And I really don't like the way it's rendered in, well, maybe it depends on where you live and what Bible translation they're using at Mass. But here's what it actually says. And this is Luke chapter 1, verse 28. So this is, of course, the Annunciation. And I'm gonna start just a little bit back at verse 26. In the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a city of Galilee named Nazareth to a virgin betrothed to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David. And the virgin's name was Mary. And he came to her and said, "Hail, full of grace, the Lord is with you." Now, in some Bible translations, it actually says something like, "Hail, O highly favored daughter," or "favored one," or something like that. That's not what it says in the original text. In the original Greek text of the New Testament that Luke wrote, Dr. Luke, the author of Luke's Gospel, the author of the Acts of the Apostles, which is kind of part two of his two-volume set, that's not what it says. So that word that's translated as "full of grace," and that's where the Hail Mary comes from, it's very scriptural, "Hail, full of grace," it's the Greek word kekaratomene, kekaratomene. Now, I am not that great of a language scholar, and you know, I always was kind of bad at grammar, but I do know this. I had to study Greek a little bit when I was doing my graduate work for New Testament, and kekaratomene is a past perfect, and it comes from the root word charis, or grace. And basically what it means is one who has been made full of God's grace. So it's a past perfect. It means that something happened perfectly in the past, and it continues all the way out, like kind of on a timeline, all the way out into the future as far as the eye can see, and even beyond into eternity. So it's a past perfect. So that means at some point in the past, Mary was made perfectly full of God's grace. Now, if there was any sin in her life, original or personal, she can't be perfectly full of God's grace. It'd have to be some room for sin, but that's not the case. That's not the case. And by the way, this is the only time in the entire Bible that an angel greets somebody by their title, not by their name. He doesn't say, "Oh, you know, hello, Mary." He says, "Hail, full of grace. Hail, you who are full of God's grace." That's a title, kekaratomene. So that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. And I think that right there, you've got some scriptural evidence for the Immaculate Conception. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. We're going to take a quick break right now on the show. But when we come back, I'm going to be sharing with you some psychological objections to this. And I asked the question, does the fact that Mary is sinless, does that make her harder to relate to for you? You can call in and let me know, 1-888-914-9149. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. We'll be right back. The Relevant Radio studio line is sponsored by the Catholic Order of Foresters Flexible Premium Life Insurance. For less than $12 a month, a 40-year-old can get $500,000 of coverage. Go to relevantradio.com/forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Helping you keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the show. It is a great solemnity, a great feast day, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And we're going to get to your phone calls in just a second, but I want to emphasize once again that this is not something that the church invented, okay? A lot of people who are not a Catholic might say that, hey, the church invented the dogma of the Immaculate Conception in 1854 when Pope Pius IX kind of put it forward. Just like they say, in 1950, the church, quote-unquote, invented the dogma of the Assumption of Mary. Where are they pulling this stuff out of? We got to remember, there's a difference between development of doctrine and doctrinal invention. Okay, the church is not inventing things out of whole cloth here. And most church dogmas don't get actually defined by the church, like Pius IX did with this one in 1854, unless there's a specific reason for it. And usually a church dogma doesn't get defined until it's been attacked from the outside. And I like to say that dogmas of the church, these church teachings that you have to believe to be Catholic. Another one, of course, is the Trinity, the fact that God is a Trinity. That didn't get officially defined until it was under attack, so much so that the church nearly split in two with this, you know, jerk Arius, I'm just going to call it, the heretic who said that Jesus is not God. And this really caught on. He's wonderful. He's an incredible creature, Arius said, but he's not God. The first of God's creatures, but he's not God. Well, obviously, that's a problem, because he is God. God made man. And so that's really the Council of Nicaea. The definition of the Trinity came out at that time in the 4th century. And so dogmas are kind of like, I call them calluses on the body of Christ, the mystical body of Christ, the church. Just like in your human body, it forms calluses when it comes up against resistance, like, you know, on your heels or something like that, or you're working with, you know, tools and, you know, your hands form calluses because there's a lot of resistance. And so you've got to be really, really, got to have some hard edges to that doctrine where it's under attack from the outside. So this is something that was always true, but the church just got more insight into it over time. But even in the early church, people talked about this. And let me just give you a couple of things from the church fathers. Saint Ephraim of Syria, he's one of the most prominent doctors of the church, a father of the church. And he wrote this in a hymn. And this is, he lived from about 306 AD to 373 AD in the 4th century. And he wrote this. He said, this is a hymn to Christ. Christ alone and your mother are more beautiful than any others. There is no blemish in you, nor any stains upon our mother. Who of my children can compare in beauty to these? Yesterday, of course, was the feast of St. Ambrose, the great teacher of St. Augustine. And here's what St. Ambrose wrote in his commentary on Psalm number 118. He said, "Lift me up, not from Sarah," and he's talking about Sarah in the book of Genesis, "lift me up, not from Sarah, but from Mary, a virgin not only undefiled, but a virgin whom grace has made inviolate, free from every stain of sin." So Ambrose says Mary is free from every stain of sin. St. Augustine, his student, also one of the great fathers of the church. And most Protestants really are into St. Augustine. They should really read some of his writings about this. In his work called Nature and Grace, which he wrote in the year 415, St. Augustine said, talking about the Holy Virgin Mary, "concerning whom, on account of the honor of the Lord, I wish to have absolutely no question when talking about sin. How do we know what abundance of grace for the total overcoming of sin was conferred upon her who merited to conceive and bear him in whom there was no sin?" So again, St. Augustine says, in view of the merits of Jesus Christ, she was preserved from all sin. And by the way, in all the Marian apparitions, a lot of the approved Marian apparitions of the church, this is a huge point of contention. Mary sort of emphasizes this. The miraculous medal, Rue de Bac in France, Mary specifically asked for these words to be on the medal. "O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee." Our Lady of Lourdes, how did she identify herself to St. Bernadette? She said, "I am the Immaculate Conception." She's like, who is this lady? I don't know. "I am the Immaculate Conception." Fatima, big message of Fatima, the need to consecrate the world to the what? Immaculate Heart of Mary. So that's big. That's pretty big. And a lot of people though, still have other objections. And I want to talk about Mark Galley came out with this on Word on Fire today. He came out with a blog post. And Mark Galley used to be the editor of Christianity Today magazine. Hugely influential. So in the Protestant world, he was a big shot. He was a big gun. And he's converted to Catholicism. We talked about his conversion in the past on the Cale Clark Show here on Relevant Radio. But he talked about how some people have other struggles with it, not just biblical, theological, but he calls them psychological stumbling blocks. And I just wanted to kind of share this with you. And some of the stuff he talks about, we've already mentioned on this program tonight. But I want to get into some of these psychological issues. So one thing he mentions is that for Protestants have a mistrust of authority that's outside of yourself. Like this idea of a teaching church, an authoritative church. A lot of Protestants have an issue with that. This concept of private interpretation of the Bible is kind of foundational to the Protestant experience. And that has a lot of consequences. There's a professor from Notre Dame, I believe. His name is Brad S. Gregory. He wrote a book called The Unintended Reformation. He talked about how Martin Luther's doctrine of, hey, anybody should be able to read the Bible and come up with the right interpretation. That led to a lot of unforeseen problems. Namely, this era that we're living in now of subjectivism, relativism, this concept of there is no truth. There's only my truth, there's his truth, there's her truth, but there's no such thing as the truth, an objective overruling truth. And Martin Luther himself lamented this, even in his own time. In the 16th century, he said, there are now as many interpretations of the Bible as there are heads. In other words, everybody's got their own, and they're all arguing with each other. And it's only gotten worse since then. Obviously, there's approximately 35,000 different Protestant denominations that we know of, not counting the independent Bible churches on the corner of your street or whatever, the local Bible chapels that are kind of independent. These are known actual denominations, and they all kind of disagree with each other as well as the church on a lot of important issues. But one of the things that Mark Galley said is that the older I get, this idea that, you know, I can come up with the right interpretation on my own, in my own heart and mind, he said, the more aged I get, the more untrustworthy I find that. I find myself as a reliable source of authority. He says, I get its attraction, but I'd rather take my chances with a venerable tradition that, in collective and time-tested wisdom, seeks to understand the ways of God. Anyway, so let's get into some of the psychological problems that a lot of non-Catholics have about the Immaculate Conception. He says, first of all, there's an aesthetic problem. And he says, okay, if you're reading a novel, let's say, or you're watching a movie, let's say there's a character in that fictional story. Now, this isn't a fictional story when we're talking about Mary. She's a real person who actually existed. But let's say you're reading a piece of literature. If there's a character who's absolutely flawless in a story or perfect, some readers can't identify with that person because they're not flawless themselves, nor have they ever met a perfect person. So sometimes when a writer creates a character like that, they're charged with being naive, unrealistic, simplistic. And this is kind of which relates to my question. I've heard people say, and some women say, I can't really relate to Mary. I try to pray the rosary, but I personally can't relate to her because she was perfect. She was sinless. So I find that difficult. Now, maybe you don't. Maybe some of you don't. But some people do. Some people do. And Mark Galley says this is the reason why some readers look at some of the biographies of the saints, like hagiographies. A saint is described without having any blemishes, any faults, any temper, or anything like that. They can't relate to that, and they find that sometimes ridiculous. And that, I think that is true of non-Catholics. A lot of non-Catholic Christians do look at some of the stuff with a raised eyebrow. And we do live in a skeptical age as well. So this can be a problem for some people to kind of get this. And then he also says sometimes there's kind of an envy mixed in for some people. Because, hey, if there really was a human person who was free from sin from the moment of her conception, but in my own life, I'm having to fight against sin every day, and sometimes I lose that battle every day, year after year, it's a fight. That doesn't seem fair. Okay, Jesus, all right, he's the God-man. I kind of get that. But I think, you know, just personally speaking, this is Cale speaking too, the church there's some in the church who make the error of not thinking too much about Jesus' humanity. You've got to get both the humanity and the divinity to get Jesus right. So denying his full humanity is a problem. But when it comes to Mary, who's a human person, it seems more difficult for some people to accept her, and they're kind of envious of her in a weird sense. So anyways, Mark Galley goes on to point out something C.S. Lewis said in his, it's really a big sermon called The Weight of Glory. And C.S. Lewis said, it's a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses. What does he mean by that? Not that we're going to become gods unto ourselves, but he says to remember that the dullest, most uninteresting person that you could ever talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw that person now, you'd be strongly tempted to worship them. He's talking about our glorified state at the resurrection of the saints. C.S. Lewis says, there are no ordinary people. You've never talked to a mere mortal. They're either going to be one day in everlasting splendor or a horror, something that you wouldn't see in a film. Like, just, we're supernatural, okay? We're going to be, we have an eternal soul. We're going to live forever somewhere, either in heaven or in hell. And those are the only two possibilities. So Mark Galley says, hey, if Mary was no ordinary person, if she was no mere mortal, naturally she's the example of redeemed humanity free from sin, full of grace. That sort of does explain why Catholics, in his view, sometimes go overboard in their devotion to Mary. And sometimes if you're Catholic, you don't really think about this. And I spent 10 years outside the Catholic Church in Protestant ministry, so I kind of understand the way that non-Catholics sometimes think about this. When it's almost an excess of love, of course, and we love Our Lady, we want to show her our love. But for some non-Catholics, they think, man, they're getting really close to worshiping Mary. They've gone over the edge. And so they look at our devotion to Mary, and they don't quite get it. And I think some Catholics have crossed the line, but the Church is really, really clear. You know, worship of Mary is completely out of bounds. It'd be breaking the first commandment. We can only venerate her because she's a creature. We give her the extreme veneration. She's the greatest creature, greater than her, no one but God, but still a creature. All right. Then one last thing. And I'll get to your calls here. He says there's a moral dimension too. This is something that a lot of non-Catholics struggle with when it comes to Mary. And this is a really insightful point that Mark Galley makes here. He says that when we encounter the holy in everyday life, there's two temptations that can befall us. Number one, we can fall on our knees and say, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man." Remember when Jesus directs them to this miraculous catch of fish. They've been fishing all night, they catch nothing. Jesus says, "Hey, just chuck the nets over there." All right, whatever. And then they come up with this huge, wow, Peter's blown away. He knows he's in the presence of the divine. He says, "Hey, depart from me. I'm a sinful man." He's down on his knees. "Just leave me alone. I'm not worthy. Or that's one reaction. The other reaction that Mark Galley says we can have is we can lash out. We want to get rid of the holy. When we're in the presence of the holy, we don't want this anywhere near us because we don't like the fact that we're not holy, but somebody else is. So this is the crucify him response. So that's one of two ways we can take. We can either say, "Depart from me, for I'm sinful, you know, I'm not worthy," or "Let's get him out of here, crucify him. Because when we're in the presence of the holy, he says, our wretchedness is revealed for what it is. So at this point, we either let the holy kill our sinfulness, our sinful flesh, or we strike out and we try to kill the holy. And he says, that's another reason why I think the Immaculate Conception makes some people feel really, really uncomfortable. So I don't know. What do you think about this? 1-888-914-9149. I'm going to go to the phones right now. We're going to go to Daniel in Sacramento. Hi, Daniel.
Yeah, how you doing? Thank you for all your work that you do. This is a great show. Yeah, I think
you're welcome.
Problem is, yes, not a problem, is they're not looking at our Blessed Mother as who she are, as who she is. She is our mother. It'd be kind of like, let's say your physical mother was more beautiful than you were. And would you want her to be less beautiful so you could relate to her? I mean,
yeah.
And our Blessed Mother is the, and also in Pope Pius IX, he said in that, that at the moment of conception, and this is absolutely amazing, the Blessed Mother was more holier than all the angels and saints combined. And she is beyond anything, and she's our mother. That's the most important thing. She's our mother, and she loves us with such love because she has the humility that is, here she is, everything God created is dim. She is the most beautiful thing that God created.
Yeah, and I agree with that, Daniel, and thank you for that call. And I think part of what you're saying there is really what they call the argument from fittingness, that, you know, God could do this for his mother. If you could do this for your mother, wouldn't you? Yeah, of course. And at the end of the day, you know, Mark Galley pointed this out in his article too, that this is hard for some people to accept, but it's far from the hardest doctrine of Christianity to accept. You know, God becoming man, that his gruesome death on the cross can bring forgiveness to the world. God is a Trinity of person. Some of these doctrines are a little bit more mind-bending, he says, than even the Immaculate Conception. So again, it's Lord, I believe, help my unbelief, right? Like that father said, you know, I believe, help my unbelief. So we do need faith to believe this. We do need trust. in the teaching office of the church, but it is true. It is true. And we can take it to the bank. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149. Thanks for that call, Daniel. Really appreciate that call. And your love for Our Lady really came through in that call. We're going to go now to Wendy in Orange, California. Hi, Wendy.
Hey, Cale.
Hey, good to talk to you. What do you think about this?
Well, I'm a cradle Catholic, and so I guess I was always brought up with a real comfort coming from Mary. Mm-hmm. And so the way I think about it now that I've also been a mother is that when we're really young, we look up to our mom, and she's perfect.
Yeah.
She's the most beautiful. She's the smartest. All of those things. But we grow up, and there comes a point where we realize she's not perfect. But we never realize that with Mary, because she is perfect. And why would God come in a vessel that wasn't perfect? How could he develop perfectly in imperfection?
Yeah, and I think, yeah, that, again, that is the element of fittingness in terms of the doctrine. Yeah, I think that definitely plays into that. And thank you for that call, Wendy. Really appreciate that. Let me go to Teresa now in Long Beach, California. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You got it. Yeah.
And what are your thoughts on this? I love the subject, and I love Mary, and I'm a cradle Catholic. Mm-hmm. And even so, my parents must have instilled in me about her young, because I remember I had a procedure when I was not even 2 years old, and I remember being on a metal table and actually praying to her. She's always been a big part of our life. And I also think about her lineage. I think about, like, when I pray and thanks and praise, I think for her parents and their parents, because she was raised, you know, as a faithful Jew. And I'm grateful for them, and I think they had to be special too, because she was born to them without sin. And I'm a catechist too, and I tell my students that, you know, the devil, you know, they could have killed her while she was pregnant with Jesus, but he was afraid of her because of the fact she was without sin. She was so special that he would, you know, he didn't kill the fetus because he was afraid of Mary carrying her. She was so special, and she's so special to us. And I also want people to pray for that how we offend Jesus when people are so disrespectful to her, and this day is her day, yeah. And the first Friday of every month. And we have to do that because...
That's a great point.
And I think to myself, what of all the things she must have known that Jesus told her that we'll find out someday if we're privileged enough to go to heaven, that she was just so special.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that, Teresa. I got to jump in here just because we're up against the clock here. We got to take a break. But I really do appreciate that. We do have to pray for people that hate Mary. And there is a statue of Mary at the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C. that was recently vandalized. It's so tragic. Pray for this person. And yeah, we got to pray for a better devotion to Mary. We got to take a quick break right now on The Cale Clark Show. 888-914-9149. We'll be right back. We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
You're cool, you're crisp, you're hard to resist.
Faith, facts, and fun. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
That's a blast from the past, let me tell you. That's an incredible commercial for the champagne of ginger ales. I'm talking about Canada Dry, of course. That is the only one. So I have to ask you this question, though. You might disagree with me. This is a fun question, though. What's your favorite ginger ale? I saw this poll on Twitter that happened a few weeks ago, and people were really getting passionate about this. And the three choices that were proffered that people could choose from were, number one, Canada Dry. Is that your favorite ginger ale? Schweppes was choice number two. And choice number three was Seagram. Seagram's. And by the way, the logo for Seagram's ginger ale looks exactly like the logo for the Seattle Kraken hockey team. I don't know if that's on purpose or not. But at any rate, this is the S, the stylized S. Some people in the comments We're chiming in with these other types of ginger ale, which I'd never heard of before, but there's some sort of regional brands. I won't name them because you might throw them out to me yourself. I don't want to spoil it, but there was one particular brand that people were saying again and again, no, none of the above, it's this. So what's your favorite ginger ale of the three, or maybe you've got another one, 888-914-9149. This is a great time of year to talk about this, by the way, as well, because I don't know if this happened to you, but when I was growing up, whenever I got sick, my mom would always give me ginger ale to try to make me feel better. So I don't know if that's true in your case, but Canada Dry, the champagne of ginger ales, that was always the choice. And I'm Canadian, so I kind of have to rep Canada Dry, right? But what's your favorite ginger ale? And producer Jim says, well, I have a favorite ale, not necessarily a favorite ginger ale, but and that's true. And hey, I know what yours is, Jim. I even know what that is. That is, of course, Samuel Adams Oktoberfest. See, I know my friends really well. Yep, I gave you some. And
thanks, Kid.
You got it, man. Hey, enjoy it responsibly and enjoy it in moderation, my friend. But what about ginger ale? Well, I actually want to tell you the story, by the way. I want to tell you the story about how Canada Dry was actually invented. It's a pretty cool story. Chris Bateman was writing this for the blog TO website. And TO is an abbreviation for the city of Toronto, where I live. It's all about J.J. McLaughlin, John James McLaughlin. He was only 25 years old when he founded his soft drink empire. He was born in Ontario. He studied at the Ontario College of Pharmacy in Toronto, and he actually went to Brooklyn, New York to complete his qualifications. That's when he really started doing some experimenting. This guy, I saw a picture of him, sort of a portrait of him. He was kind of balding, but he had this big mustache, you know, kind of a handlebar type mustache. And anyways, when he was in Brooklyn completing his studies, he worked the controls of a gleaming marble soda fountain in a New York City drugstore. This was way back in the day when you could go into the drugstore and just pull up to the bar, if you will, and have a soda. And it's interesting because in the United States, they call it soda. In Canada, we call it pop. Let's split the difference and call it soda pop. And this is what J.J. McLaughlin used to do. He mixed a bunch of fruit-flavored syrups with carbonated water and ice for crowds of thirsty customers. And here's some of the drinks that he invented. This is crazy. One drink was called the Humdinger. Another one was called the American Gentleman. Another was called the Happy Hooligan. Gunther's Excelsior. I like that one. I like that one. Pugilist Panacea. The Pugilist's Panacea. And the Japanese Thirst Killer. These are all wildly popular drinks at this particular New York City drugstore at the soda bar. So J.J. McLaughlin got thinking, like, man, I think the real money is in soda pop, not in being a pharmacist. Forget that. I'm going to start a new business. So he went back to Toronto and he started distributing sparkling soda water and mineral water from a store near Old City Hall. This was in the early 1890s. And so he had these seltzer bottles and he could endlessly refill them and put carbon dioxide in them, kind of recharge them, if you will. It kind of like an early version of the Soda Stream, I guess you could say. He would just pull on the metal trigger and a burst of fizzy water would come out, tasted like salted club soda. So he did really, really well with this. The business started to grow and he started making other types of drinks: sarsaparilla, lemon sour, cream soda, ginger beer, which became ginger ale, which became Canada Dry, and also cola. He had kind of a knockoff to Coca-Cola. It's really shameless ripoff. I'll tell you about that in just a second. But anyways, this guy was a crazy entrepreneur. He started making he marketed a bottle washing machine that he invented that would scrub, sterilize, and dry used soda pop bottles ready for refilling. Sold really, really well. People in overseas bought it in England and in Europe and all over the place. His brother wasn't a shabby businessman either. His brother Samuel McLaughlin actually turned his father's business into General Motors of Canada. So how about that? Anyways, these guys just kept expanding, kept producing. At one point, they had fruit handlers filling the basement of their factory, peeling oranges, lemons, cherries, berries, peaches, plums, stacked floor to ceiling, and they would actually get real fruit into their drink. That was part of the syrup, and pretty awesome stuff. Anyways, his fake Coca-Cola was called Tuna Cola, which had the exact same script as Coca-Cola. It was a shameless ripoff. I'm sure they would have been sued. if it were the modern day age. And anyways, they would sell it at soda fountains and drugstores for 5 cents a glass. Pretty good deal. And of course, back in the day, people thought that these soft drinks were health tonics. Coca-Cola was thought to have health benefits. Dr. Pepper, that's why they call it Dr. Pepper, because it'll cure what ails you, right? Now, of course, the original version of Coca-Cola contained actual cocaine, so it certainly gave people more than a bit of a jolt, that's for sure, and that was quickly shut down. But Canada Dry used to be called McLaughlin, because the guy's name was J.J. McLaughlin, McLaughlin's Belfast-style ginger ale. And then he renamed it in 1904 Canada Dry Pale Ginger Ale. Early ads would say it has a snap and a tingle, a smart, spry taste. And he eventually started calling it the champagne of ginger ales, and it became super, super popular, as you know. Now, unfortunately, J.J. McLaughlin died suddenly of a heart attack in 1914 when Canada Dry was just getting popular, and the company has been sold. Today, it's no longer associated with Canada at all. In fact, Canada Dry is owned by one of the great rivals, Dr. Pepper. Dr. Pepper swooped in, and the Dr. Pepper Snapple Group, which is based out of Plano, Texas. This article calls it a faceless corporation. I think that's pretty harsh. I actually love Dr. Pepper. I love Diet Dr. Pepper as well. And Mr. Pibb, all that stuff, just like my pal Chuck Swirsky. He's always talking about Mr. Pibb. This is the same company, by the way, that produces 7-Up, A&W Root Beer, Clamato, Yoo-Hoo, countless other drinks. So Canada Dry is kind of under this umbrella, this conglomerate. And so that's what happened to it, but it's still the champagne of ginger ales. Now, I want to see what you think. What is the best ginger ale? Well, let's go to Janelle in Milwaukee. What do you think, Janelle?
Verner's.
Verner's. What do you like about it?
Well, grew up with it. My dad's from Canada, and we always had it in our house. And our family continues to love it so much, we actually named our dog Vern.
I love it. I love it. Hey, when pets get named after it, you know you love it. So I got to try Verner's. I got to try this. This everyone is talking about Verner's. So Janelle, thank you so much for chiming in on this. Janelle in Milwaukee, call back anytime. Producer Jim, you got to get me a case of Verner's, man. I'll tell you. All right, let's go to Bridget in Montgomery, Illinois. Hi, Bridget.
Hello. I'm taking an Oscar so I don't get in trouble.
Which one are you going to go
Big
with?
Big reveal, Canada Dry.
All right.
It's all
good,
we had.
Good.
And,
you're correct. No,
love it. I stock up on it all through COVID. Got to have the Canada Dry. And it was also Canada. The ginger ale was part of our go-to punch for the holidays. It was, you know, Hawaiian punch.
Hey, that's right.
Orange juice, ginger ale, and then sherbet, rainbow sherbet.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Hey, real quick, Janine in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Janine, we got about 30 seconds. What do you think? What is your favorite ginger ale?
Another vote for Verner's. I was given it as a child, and I used to live in Ohio, but now I live in North Carolina where it's hard to get, but there's this little general store in Wake Forest, and I order it by the case from them. Actually, I have a bottle of it in my car right now. I just finished a bottle.
Wow. Well, Janine, thanks for that. Hey, call back anytime. A lot of votes for Verner's. I got to try this stuff. I got to see if it'll challenge my Canada Dry. I don't know. But hey, when you're buying it by the case, you know you love it. You know you love it. And hey, it's a good thing to talk about because, you know, flu season, colds are out there. We're going to be sick at some point. Got to have a ginger ale handy to cure what ails you. Well, I hope this show cured some of your miseries of some sorts. And happy to spend this hour with you. It's Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Please stay tuned to Relevant. Keep it locked here. Timory's up next. And of course, the Family Rosary Across America with Father Rocky's coming up too. My show will be back tomorrow. Jim produced, Patrick took your calls. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.